Welcome to Planetary Conversations. I'm your host, Warren Bell. Each week I talk with experienced and knowledgeable guests from all backgrounds and walks of life as we explore ideas and actions that can restore the health of our planet and heal our relations with one another. Check out our website at voiceoftheshoeshop.ca, and you can find all our episodes on Spotify and Apple Podcasts. But first, we openly and freely acknowledge that we live and work in Shukapmakulu, the stolen, ancestral, and unceded lands of the Suquepic people. We in the settler community have a critical responsibility to do our very best to resolve this historical injustice in a way that is satisfactory to our Indigenous friends and neighbors. Many observers have commented that today's high-level political figures appear to be lost and confused, while community-centered citizen activists are really driving meaningful change. This makes sense because for most of the 300,000 years of Homo sapiens' existence, we have lived in small gatherings or communities in which we got to know each other and learned how to cooperate effectively because we could see strengths and weaknesses in our friends and neighbors. There's something important about knowing people personally when you want to get something done. Now, in today's turbulent world in which urgent global challenges affect every person in every community, taking action for change is no longer an option. It's a necessity. Among many challenges, none are more important than the disruptive and destructive impacts we humans are now having on our planetary home and on one another. Overconsumption of the planet's resources, pollution, gross material inequity, and what has been called the sixth mass extinction are just some of the problems we have created. And underlying them all is something we all experience on a day-to-day basis, a clear-cut and now unmistakable change in the Earth's climate. From melting polar glaciers to heat domes to expanding deserts, to devastating extreme weather events, humanity is discovering that we have inadvertently developed the power to change what we might call the planet's metabolism. We have changed the energy flow and circulation in air and water and are thus bringing on what we might well be calling a progressive planetary fever. Global climate changes have happened many times in the past, some far more extreme than at the present. These have all taken place slowly, however, over hundreds of thousands or sometimes even millions of years, allowing living organisms time to adapt. According to geological and other evidence, apart from the meteorite impact 60 million years ago that eliminated the dinosaurs almost overnight, no change in climate has taken place as quickly as the one we are now causing. It is the rapidity of climate change that is making life equally difficult for us and all life forms. The climate crisis is something to which, one way or another, we are all contributing. The largest contributor to the crisis is our widespread use of fossil fuels, coal, oil, and gas, whose abundant energy content has played an important role in advancing many improvements in our lives for the last 150 years. But now, the dark side of this process is clear. Greenhouse gases generated by burning fossil fuels has generated a relentless increase in temperatures on the surface of our planet, an increase that will eventually make the planet profoundly inhospitable for most of today's forms of life, including us. We owe it to future generations to address this issue, and if our high-level leaders are stalled, then we must take up the challenge at the grassroots level. Today's guest is someone who's done exactly that. Julia Beatty is a retired professional biologist and the active chair of the Shuswap Climate Action Society. Julia is going to share her story of transitioning from a long career in large-scale government regulatory work to becoming an engaged community climate activist. We're also going to learn why it is important for all of us, one way or another, to become part of the activist community. Julia, welcome. It's great to have you join us here in the studio.
Thank you, Warren. I'm really happy to be here.
But let's talk about the society that you created or helped to create. It was a kind of a joint effort. The Shuswap Climate Action Society. You founded it in 2019, but it took a couple of years before you became a registered society. At the time that it was founding, you said there was a couple of things that were going on. There was an election and there was Greta Thunberg. So why don't you link Greta and the federal government's election as motivating factors?
Yes, I don't know whether they're really linked, but it just so happened that in 2019, there was a federal election. And for the first time in a long time, environment was the top three issues at the time. And Greta Thunberg was also a rising figure in the climate activist arena. And she inspired thousands, hundreds of thousands of people to protest that
year. Quite astonishing, wasn't it?
It was amazing. And so it was that year that I decided to organize a climate march here in Salmon Arm. And we invited actually all of the candidates who were running for the federal election in this riding that year to come and talk, any of them that had anything to say. And also, there was some local councillors who also spoke. But it was an event that attracted well over 200 people from a community, a small community like Salmon Arm.
17,000.
And it was pretty amazing. And it inspired me actually to think about how after the federal election, how could we keep the momentum going and keep the advocacy going for, particularly for climate change.
I had a look at the constitution of the society, because that always tells a person who is just looking at it, what are some of the things going on that motivate things? And I was struck by a couple of things, because either they're new from the provincial government or there are things that you put into the rules that you laid out for yourselves. One is that you used words like support and educate and engage. You know, often when people are talking about climate issues, they talk about fighting, you know, this or pushing against or struggling, something along those lines. And you used quite positive words. Were you thinking, was that you guys thinking about how you wanted to present yourself?
Yeah. At the time, we had created the group, and our board of directors at the time, we sat down and decided we needed to establish a constitution and bylaws and a code of conduct. And I think we all agreed at the time that you attract a lot more bees with honey than vinegar. And actually, having worked with government, I understood that it's way better to try and work with people than to try and fight them.
You also used in your vision statement a fairly ambitious phraseology. The North Okanagan and Shuswap is a leader in climate action, building resilient communities. Now, that's laying out a really ambitious but also realistic vision. I mean, at some point, that's got to happen, whether we're leaders among all the other communities in the planet or whether it's only here, it's got to happen. Is that what you sort of were thinking? Community by community sort of thing.
Yeah. And, you know, if you want to have an overarching goal, then your vision should be, you know, somewhat advanced and, ambitious. Mm-hmm. And so that's why we, you know, created that particular vision statement. And I think it's not out of the ordinary to have a lot of people who are, you know, wanting more action on climate to see their community doing all the right things.
You also have a mission statement that says, use two words. It uses the word knowledge, supporting community knowledge, and solutions. In other words, you wanted to make things clear to people and have them change because it was clear and change in the form of actions. I mean, it seems like a pretty direct connection between they know there's a problem, and then they have to do something about it.
Yeah. There's a lot of people don't really understand the science of climate. And I don't think you necessarily have to understand it in a deep way, in a research kind of way. But understanding the elements of climate change and understanding what we can all do, I think gives people you know, the kind of agency they need to take control of a situation that, from my perspective, is an existential threat.
And when we don't talk to each other about it, Mother Nature sends us a little message once in a while in the form of a massive flood or a heat dome or something along those lines. Now, one thing you did, which is clearly a step into the future, we said that voting members could be as young as 16 years of age. Now, the federal and the provincial governments are struggling with this notion. They say it's a good idea, but you actually went straight into that. What were you thinking about by having younger people involved? I think I have a guess.
Yeah. Well, they are actually the demographic that has everything at risk. And they've got everything to fight for. You know, we've done a poor job as a generation. I'm now in my 70s. We've done a poor job as a generation to put the next generations on good footing and have a livable planet. And so it's up to them now, you know, to take the mantle and speak up.
Another thing that I remember from being involved with the establishment of a number of societies was that the usual Roberts rules has president, vice president, treasurer, and secretary. Now you have a chairperson. Was that you doing that, or was that a change in the bylaw template you got from the provincial government?
Actually, the template we used was from the SPCA.
Oh.
I think we all agreed at the time that rather than president and vice president, we certainly need a secretary and treasurer. but, you know, the, I guess, designation of a chair and vice chair was a little more egalitarian,
yeah. You
know, a little like I'm not the president. I'm just simply one of a board.
And the other term was the moderator, which is mm-hmm. used, I think, the United Church as a moderator. Mm-hmm. And that, again, implies just kind of keeping things flowing along on an even keel. I mean, I think these details are kind of important because they reflect an attitude, you know, or a set of values, you might say. The code of conduct is really, it's a humdinger. It's very complete. Now, was this one that you folks created?
Yes.
I'm very impressed by it, by the way.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, it wasn't originally part of our constitution, but we found that we felt it was important to institute a code of conduct, both for our board and our members, to make us more accountable.
Yeah.
And remind us of respect, mutual respect.
I'd like to read it because I think these are listeners, not viewers, so they can't hold it up. But I think it's really quite impressive, and it certainly struck me as I read it. So here it is. It is imperative that interactions within and outside the Shuswap Climate Action Society membership reflect high standards for ethical behavior, including fairness, openness, honesty, integrity, equality, and dignity, and are always respectful of the opinions of others. I hope you feel a little proud of that. It's pretty much asking everybody to be really, really nice to each other.
Yeah, and it was there was a smaller team of us from the board of directors who put that together. And I think it just reflects how we all felt at the time.
Another thing I noticed was that right on early on on the website, you have a listing of other groups that you're related to or working with, and you call them sister organizations. And that brings up an issue that's come up often in discussions on this program, but also elsewhere, and that is the role that women play in transformational change, because it's quite obvious now to many people that women are coming forward, that they have often a better understanding of how to induce change in a peaceful, collaborative way rather than an oppositional or confrontational way. What were you thinking when you said sister organizations?
To be frank, both of those organizations are led by women.
Mm-hmm. I was very aware of that. I was going to get to that because it's very clear. Many of them, yeah.
Yeah. And I'm not sure I mean, that was certainly probably, you know, the primary reason that we used that term. But I also think that many women have a real maternal instinct, whether it's, you know, people or the environment. Mm-hmm. I think that there's a real drive in us to keep, you know, that love going.
To care.
And care. And, yeah. Love and care.
Yeah. Well, I think it's a very wise step. And I think the fact that you phrased it that way was part of the transformational process. You know, going from yelling at each other, which there are many places people do that in, to conversing with each other and attempting to achieve a consensus. It seems to me that's what we have to do anyway. Now, the society is linked to these two sister organizations. One is the Armstrong Spalanchine Climate Action Organization, and the other is the Chase Environmental Action Society, which itself is further linked to Future Ground Network / David Suzuki Foundation and the West Coast Environmental Action Network. It seems to me that from the get-go, there was this idea that you're not, you know, leading the charge. You're part of a movement in which you play a role and other people play a role, and you're all really working together.
Yeah, this is really critical, actually, in all the work that we do. We keep in very close contact with our colleagues in other parts of the Okanagan, First Things First Okanagan in Penticton, the Okanagan Climate Hub out of Kelowna, in addition to the West Coast Climate Action Network,
yes.
and the David Suzuki Foundation and Stand Earth. I mean, there's a whole slew of them
that we
keep in touch with.
Some of the people that are involved were Kelly Westgate, involved with the permaculture movement, who involved herself with the garden at the Salvation Army. Sigrid Kendrick is involved with the Xeriscapes, which is an important way of conserving energy and reducing fossil fuel use. Sarah Johnson, a beekeeper and very involved with the beekeeping movement. And Michaela Cannon, who we had the good fortune to interview here, who's really an amazing woman involved with foraging and finding food in the forest around you rather than going to the supermarket. Well, this was also connected with the Lose the Lawn campaign. And that was one of your very first campaigns. Why don't you talk about that a little bit and what you were aiming at doing there?
Yeah, you know, one of the three crises that we're dealing with is not just pollution and climate change, but also biodiversity. And as a biologist, I know that it's really important to, as we're losing all kinds of habitat, how about let's create some habitat? And lawns are about the most useless piece of yard.
Very barren kind of landscape.
Yeah, especially if they're, you know, fertilized and herbicided. Mm-hmm. That's just death for biodiversity.
Mm-hmm.
And so we thought, it's a movement that has actually started and continues, and it's getting stronger and stronger,
mm-hmm.
is to let's transition our yards into something that creates habitat,
yes.
and provides pollinators, the pollen and nectar and hummingbirds and all kinds of critters,
mm-hmm.
bring them into our backyard. And let's provide for them as opposed to taking away from them.
Another phrase you used in this project was rewilding your yard,
mm-hmm.
making it a place where, as you say, animals, because we live in a rural area and there are lots of critters, as you said, roaming around, some very large and some quite tiny, and they all like to have a place to hang out. And if they hang out, they actually bring various kinds of assets, you know, as well. You know, some of the animals produce a little fertilizer, and some of them just give us all a great deal of pleasure to see them in our spaces. Now, you also have a long list of resources on the website, and they range from books. I had printed all the books out in my notes here, but they took like a whole page. One of which I think is particularly relevant, and that's a book about Shkupik culture and the practices that were adopted by the people who lived here for 10,000, 12,000, 15,000 years before we got here. Maybe you could just talk about that a little bit, about how we're starting to become aware that these common ancestors, if you like, of human, the human race, have something to teach us about how we live in any given ecosystem.
Yeah, you know, my understanding is that the indigenous people had a much different relationship with nature, Mother Nature, than typical North American settlers. And I think that they lived in a much greater harmony with their surroundings than we do. Settlers want to dominate. We think that we're the top of the heap. And that's, you know, not the way I think traditional indigenous values see the world. And so we can learn a great deal from them. And we are always trying to connect with our indigenous neighbors.
I remember hearing a recording of Mary Thomas talking about going out along the edge of the lake and harvesting some of the native plants that they ate. The wapato, or the Indian potato, was one that they, the women and the grandparents and the children would all go out. The men were off chasing Bambi, and they were all at home. And they would tramp the riparian area to sort of stir it up, because that made the plants grow more actively when they disturbed them. And they'd throw them on the shore, and the kids would throw them in a basket, and they'd take them. It was the first spring food. And Dawson, he of Dawson Creek and Dawson City, and a well-known surveyor and engineer who came through BC, looked at the same place where they're harvesting wapato and said, well, there's nothing here, and just moved on. Saw nothing. He was completely oblivious to the fact this was a food source. And I think that kind of captures a little bit of what you're talking about, how you look at the landscape differently. You look at it as a source of some virtues rather than something that you can use for yourself.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Your list of other resources is sort of a who's who, or a what's what, of projects and individuals and organizations. The first one struck me was Paul Hawkins' project Drawdown, which he started, but which has taken over off on its own. One of the things that came out of Project Drawdown was that the fastest way to address climate was to increase women and girls' human and civil rights. Now, doesn't it give you a sense that you're on the right track with centering it around women and women's voices and women's insights?
Yeah, I think it's a natural progression, really, of women. If you give them the education and the ability to stand up and speak, they will, and they have a lot to say.
Isn't it sort of one of those situations where if you say, I'm willing to listen, and you do, then people will speak? If you say, I'm willing to listen, then you start talking, you know, then you may never hear them. Some of the other group, Pacific Institute for Climate Solutions, the National Geographic Society, where you've turned for some information, the Canadian Center for Climate Services, the Climate Atlas of Canada, which is a very interesting document, Community Research Connections Consortium, the One UN Climate Change Learning Partnership. I mean, it goes on and on. You've really done a lot of homework to find out who else is doing what you're doing, rather than seeing yourself as this central group to the process. I think that's something that women do better than men as well. Pardon me, I'm a man. I'm allowed to say that. Sorry, all the men listening.
We did try and curate a lot of resources for the website. It's certainly not exhaustive, but there's a lot of good information out there. And people, you know, if they use the resources pages, that's terrific.
Well, I don't know how they couldn't, because it's such a comprehensive list. And a direct link on your website to the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. It's like, just click on it and you go straight to them. The other campaign that you started off with was one around heat pumps. Why don't you give us the lowdown on heat pumps?
Well, they are a very efficient piece of technology, and they also do heating and cooling, so you don't need to have, say, a furnace and an air conditioner. And the technology has been improving even in the last several years, and it continues to improve. And there are means of heating and cooling your house, making it more comfortable. It keeps the air cleaner. They're safe. They're like three or four times more efficient than typical electric, and also more efficient than gas.
Hmm. Do they have any drawbacks? I mean, the technology I know is advancing so quickly that what you thought was a drawback 6 months ago is now being resolved and it's no longer there. Mm-hmm. Apart from their cost, but their cost is relatively less than the cost of having, as you said, separate air conditioning and heating.
Yeah. Typically now the builders are saying that it is cheaper to build with fully electric heat pumps and heat pump water heaters, and because you don't have to put a ducting system in the mm-hmm. house. Mm-hmm. And if you design the house accordingly, the heat and cool moves around in your house pretty efficiently. So when the envelopes are a little tighter, it keeps the air cleaner. So for instance, during a smoky period in the summer, that smoke doesn't infiltrate into the house as readily as it would in a sort of
standard
construction. Yeah,
indeed. Now, I think, as just about every guest we've ever had on the show, there's always reasons why you ended up doing what you're doing. And I think the first reason that you shared with me was that you collected bugs when you were young, and they were your friends. Your mother even called them your friends. Why don't you talk about that scenario?
It was like really early on when I was a kid. Yeah. And I don't even really remember a lot of it, but my mother tells me, she told me that I would come in from outside playing for lunch, and I would have my hand holding something, and she would say, "Julie, what have you got in your hand?" And I would say, "My friends." And so she'd say, "Well, let me see your friends." And I'd open my palm, and there would be an assortment of bugs. Uh-huh. And she'd say, "Well, how about you leave your friends outside while you have lunch?" So I guess, and she told me later that she said, "I should have known you were going to be a biologist."
Well, it starts off in that way. It started with David Suzuki. His father mm-hmm. took him down to the seashore, and they collected animals, little animals and insects and stuff. When you were a little older, you also became interested in animals in general. One thing you said to me was you always bred animals. You always had some kind of process at work, culminating, of course, in horses. And horses are, what role for you personally has your association with all kind of different life forms played in shaping what you're doing?
I guess it's given me an appreciation for all life forms, whether it's the tiniest little insect or the largest horse. I've just always loved animals, like all kinds of animals.
Well, they are lovely. I think you've got a good gig going there, loving animals. Your dad was an important influence for you. His work was selling industrial machinery and stuff like that, but he kind of set you in a course by just encouraging you to do something meaningful that mattered to you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. After finishing high school, I lived in Ontario at the time. We lived there. I went to university in a science program. I wasn't really sure what I wanted to do with it. And I quit university and went to college for a week in the animal health technology program at Seneca College. And in that week, I just went, "Nah, this is not really what I want to do." Went back to university, got into, again, a Bachelor of Science program. And my dad picked me up from York University and was driving me home. He said, Julie, I don't really care what you do, but just make up your mind and do something that you really want to do.
Hmm.
Like, quit messing around, make up your mind and go for it. And so he encouraged me, and my mother was encouraging me at the time to go into nursing because she thought that was a good job to do before you got married. And that's not really how I viewed the world.
No.
But my dad, I think he kind of understood that, you know, I wanted something more out of life than, and I'm not the nursey type, really, but yeah, I just wanted something more.
Sure. The influence that parents have on us is often unclear, or it's sort of subliminal. You know it's there, but you don't think about it. It's just part of the wallpaper. You know, that's the way things are. But eventually, you did start to get into stuff that mattered to you. And your father's death was a bit of a boost in that sense. It was sort of like, okay, it's me now. I'm the generation that has to start doing something. When you went and saw, you said earlier you wanted to go into veterinary medicine, but then you saw a lot of very unwell animals, and it was just too challenging. So you went to Guelph University, did a degree in marine biology, and the way you described it to me when we were talking earlier was that you thought you'd be out chasing whales. You'd be out in the ocean, which are very interesting animals.
Oh, they are, yeah. And I've actually, while I was doing environmental work on a boat, a research boat with the Forest Service, I actually saw some gray whales go by, and I was just like in awe. So yeah, I sort of saw myself doing something romantic, like probably many ideological young people do. Sure. I'm going to go chase whales.
Well, you didn't move too far away from that, because I think you wanted a job, and there was an opportunity. The BC Ministry of Environment was hiring, and you walked in and said, "Here I am." And what happened next?
Yeah.
A young biologist walked into the room to speak to the regulator, and what happened next was very interesting.
Yeah, surprising, actually. Yeah, I had been with a degree in biology, just a Bachelor of Science. I was looking for work, really having a difficult time, like many kids do this in this generation as well. Had a lot of people saying, yeah, you know, a Bachelor of Science is a dime a dozen. And thank you, but no thanks. We don't need you. And I heard I had about 3 or 4 part-time jobs, you know, sort of eking together some kind of income. And I heard that the Ministry of Environment in Surrey was hiring. And this was in the Waste Management Branch, at the time called Waste Management Branch. So I went in, filled out an application, and they hired me on the spot. And they put me in the environmental section because I had a degree in biology. And, I mean, the rest is kind of history. But that was, you know, just a stroke of luck. And what was even luckier about it was that it was a really interesting field of science. It was a kind of a new science, environmental assessment. And yeah.
And you got into doing field work. It wasn't sitting in an office, you know, writing documents. I mean, you had to do some of that, of course. Any government job does involve that. But you were out looking at what was going on in the real world, if you want to call it that.
Yeah. So as a field biologist, you are most of the time in the field collecting data. And that would be water quality data, soils, sediments, bugs, you name it, doing response to environmental pollution, complaints, agriculture, everything from agriculture to municipal sewage. We covered everything.
And what did you see? What was the pattern you saw in the community at large when you were going to various occupational sites, to various communities? What were you seeing people doing that you had to play some role in intervening with?
Yeah, well, you know, a lot of what we dealt with were permittees who were discharging some kind of pollutant into either air or water.
Was this quite common? Like, that there was a lot of people just saying, oh, well, there's an empty space, we'll just pour it in there, or there's a river or whatever.
Well, yeah.
Common then than now.
Was far more common then. Yeah. And I believe that the Waste Management Act was just kind of a new piece of legislation for the province. So they were quickly trying to get these companies under permit and trying to get like all those kind of things organized and under the regulation. So it would reduce the pollution.
And you were a young woman, and we've already talked a little bit about the different perceptions of men and women in various kinds of employment. And you met with your share of people dismissing you because you were a woman. I remember you told me about driving onto a mine site and two young dudes came over. Could you tell the story of the two young dudes?
So I was doing an inspection at a mine site looking at everything under the permit that was required. So I drove up in a truck and I rolled down the window and two guys walked over and said, what's a little
girl
and said, what's a little girl like you driving a big truck? And
speaking as a male, I apologize now for all the males who.
Yeah. Anyways, it was intentionally demeaning. Mm. And I just looked at them and got very businesslike and said, I'm here to do a permit inspection. I hope you're, ready for this.
And how were they at all chastened or did they just kind of walk off scratching their heads?
Yeah, I don't know. I just got down to work. I wasn't going to mess around with their foolery.
And you were involved with inspecting sites where there were real problems with serious pollution. One of them being the now called Teck, but Cominco site in Trail, which has become legendary for its past behavior with pollution. What kind of experiences did you have there? Because you weren't there all the time, but you went there for a while and you were involved with what was going on.
Yeah, so my job in 1993 changed. I had been working up in Smithers, primarily mining, and mining impact assessments, and got a job with the ministry in Nelson as their environmental section head. And the industrial section head at the time took me on a tour of the region so I could get familiar with the major dischargers.
And I want to just interject here that you, at that time, the industrial and the environmental sections were totally different sections and they didn't really interact all that much.
Yes, they did. We were under the Environmental Protection Branch, and there was three sections, actually. There was a municipal, industrial, and environmental section. And the environmental section did the impact assessment work, whether it was air sheds or watersheds. And our information and data and recommendations were then sent to either the municipal or industrial sections for incorporation into permits. So we would recommend permit limits and we would to protect the environment. Mm-hmm. And we would also recommend monitoring programs that would be incorporated into the permit requirements.
And what would happen to your recommendations?
Well, most of the time I would say that they were taken, but occasionally they were not. And there was no obligation on the part of the engineers to take all of our recommendations.
Did you ever understand what the criteria were for them taking or not taking your recommendations? Because probably most of the time you would be asking them to limit something they were doing or redirect it or install some machinery that did a better job with managing some kind of pollutant.
I think the criteria was probably in the head of the engineer.
And so at that point, it wasn't written out. It wasn't said, thou shalt not do this, or you can do that, but not the other thing.
There were a set of, I guess they would be guidelines for permit discharges. Thou shalt not exceed this amount. But in sensitive environments, those might not have been protective enough.
Hmm. You saw things happening in the Cominco operation that were really clear-cut, either not paying attention to the rules, or assuming that there were no rules, people dumping or pouring pollutants into watercourses, for example.
Mm-hmm.
What was that like for you? Here you are, you love all living things. You know that some are going to take a hit when this kind of stuff happens. How did you deal with that internally? That must have been a challenge.
It certainly was. And we would try and work with the engineers and the companies. And we would meet with company and their consultants and try and bring them to a place that was more environmentally protective. The first time I saw Cominco, I was standing with the industrial section head across the river, across the Lower Columbia River, looking at a flume with occasional slag pouring down it directly into the river. The slag was like a gray slate kind of looking material. And it was pretty bad. My comment to the industrial section head was, like, you allow this?
And what did he say back?
He said, yes. Well, we're trying to get them to change their process and collect this and treat it.
Did you sense that your concerns were connected to any kind of ambivalence among the people you were talking to, like this gentleman who was saying, well, we're trying to do something about it? Or did he seem to be comfortable at that time in the fact that we're going to do this? Yeah, probably not right, but that's life, you know, just.
Yeah, well, he had previously worked for the company, and I think he was, you know, fairly sympathetic with the position they were in. And they were, at the time, just moving to a new process in the smelter, the new KIVCET process. Yeah. So I guess he was, you know, sort of a little more sympathetic than I might have been.
You told me that your nickname was the Iron Maiden, and satisfactorily, that you were proud of it. It was an accurate reflection of what you believed in. You believed in doing the right thing with regard to other life forms.
Yeah, and I think it was also just, I had a fairly strict upbringing. Rules are rules. You stick with the rules. And if you don't, you're going to get dinged.
Mm.
And I felt the same way, whether I was dealing with a municipality or an industry.
But did you ever have to enforce environmental rules that you disagreed with? You know, we shouldn't protect the fish or the birds or, you know, the terrestrial animals that much. We should, you know, let them take a hit. Or was it more that you believed in the rules, not just because they were rules, but because they resonated with what you felt was right?
Some of the rules probably were not restrictive enough. But they were the rules. And we also had opportunities to try and change those rules and make them more restrictive if necessary.
And how would that come about to bring about change?
Well,
like
that would be done just through conversations with the industrial guys who were creating the permits.
Within the ministry.
We would have to justify why we were asking for more stringent requirements on a particular industry or company.
And when you were working there, how sympathetic did you find the industrial team? Were they kind of sighing a little bit, or were they actually comfortable and say, well, that makes sense. You know, this science is sound. Let's do it.
I would say that for the most part, they were pretty sensitive to what we were trying to do. You find the full range of opinion, when you're working in a large, you know,
organization
sure. such as the Ministry of Environment.
Yes.
So you come across all kinds of different spectrums of opinion on that.
Now, in the middle of all this, for light entertainment, you went to Russia.
Oh,
you
yes.
went to Russia just as Vladimir Putin was consolidating his power, rather unpleasantly, as it turns out. It was with Sita, Canadian International Development Agency. What were you doing in Russia?
Yeah, it was a scientific exchange with, it was kind of coordinated by the CCME, the Canadian Council of Ministers of the Environment. And we were sharing our information on the management of large river systems with respect to industrial pollution. And so because of my experience with the Lower Columbia River that had a pulp mill and a lead smelter, I was invited to go and speak.
And did you get a sense of what kind of attitudes there were in the Russian scientific community about issues like this?
Yeah, we were really well aligned with the researchers. Maybe not so much government officials, but we were certainly well aligned.
You spoke the same language.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
What was that like?
Science is science.
Yes. It's a universal language, or can be a universal language.
Yeah.
How much did that affect you, seeing people sort of a few thousand kilometers away in a different country, in a different culture, sharing, you know, like a lingua franca, the language of science, as you called it? What was that like to say, oh, golly, we're not alone?
Yeah, it was a spectacular experience, and I was really actually quite lucky to have participated in the exchange. And we met a lot of really nice people. Mm-hmm. And and saw some country that was, we did a little bit of traveling while we were there. And so it was a real eye-opener, a very different country, socially and culturally.
Indeed it is. Indeed it is. You also went to Holland.
Mm-hmm.
What did you go to Holland and do? What was that break all about?
I was horse shopping with a couple of girlfriends. it was kind of one of those bucket list kind of things. I had a horse and he was aging, and I couldn't find a horse locally that was sound and bred to do the kind of work that I wanted to do. I ride dressage. And so a couple of girlfriends and I thought, well, hey, why don't we go to Holland to look for horses?
And did you find one?
I did, actually. We all did.
Really?
Yes. Yeah.
So what is Holland known for, raising horses that are particularly apt for this kind of activity?
Yes, yes, they are. Yeah. And we met a lot of really nice people, rode a lot of horses. And we all found a nice horse.
And you probably met people who really liked horses too.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
So another experience of international shared attitudes about things.
Yeah.
It just seems to me that one of the things that is really important when we're dealing with global issues is to understand what people in other parts of the world think. Obviously, if you'd gone to Africa or to South Asia, you might have seen even more different kinds of cultures. But at least seeing one or two, I think that's why people travel when they're young. They think they know everything and they go to a faraway place and, oh my goodness, maybe I don't. But you also traveled a lot in BC. Your work in BC took you all over the province.
Mm-hmm.
What did you learn by seeing a lot of variety in the way people conducted themselves vis-a-vis the environment? What sort of general thing did you see?
Oh, wow. Besides just the beautiful landscapes, there was a real, again, a range of industrial impact, shall we say. Mm-hmm. For me, it was sometimes a little bit disturbing to see that the impacts were, irreversible, probably, in many respects, and especially in the mining industry.
Pollution in particular.
Yeah, and just, changing the landscape. I mean, you look at the coal mining in the East Kootenays, those places will never be the same. And that has resulted in pollution that is, I would say, almost irreversible and unstoppable. And it's resulting in international problems for Canada.
It's interesting that Teck sold off its coal mining operations to an international consortium based in the UK. one little bit of irony, there was a Woman of the Year award from the YWCA, and the president at the time of Canadian Association of Physicians for the Environment won it, but the sponsor was tech. And we had a bit of a discussion within the Canadian Association of Physicians for the Environment, because this was a very weird situation to be caught in. Now, one thing that also is part of what you've done is pursuing educational opportunities. The CETA thing was a sort of an educational thing as well as a learning experience in many other ways. You eventually obtained your registered professional biologist designation, your professional agrologist designation. But also you went back to school. You did a hydrology course at the University of Waterloo. What was that all about? That was just a little while ago.
Yeah, that was in aid of getting my agrologist, professional agrologist accreditation. Mm. And I also did another course at UBC. Also to have the correct courses to get an agrologist, a professional agrologist accreditation. So, and that was just to expand my understanding and knowledge of the world.
So you weren't thinking of getting another kind of job. You just wanted to know better what some aspects of what the work you did.
Yes. And it did open doors to other professional opportunities mm-hmm. as well, where a professional biologist wasn't necessarily one of the requirements for the position, but a professional agrologist would have been.
Isn't it interesting how when you have multiple strands of understanding and learning and insight and training, it really makes you almost could say a better person. You know, you don't make as many mistakes when you know different kinds of what people now call knowledges, you know, different kinds of groups of facts associated with one another. One thing that I think underlines some of the dilemmas we've been talking about, the dilemmas between vested interests versus environmental protection, is that after you retired, you went boldly into forming your own business. And part of it was becoming a qualified environmental professional, or a QEP. And the QEP is part of the so-called professional reliance model, meaning, in case listeners have never heard of this before, that a proponent for a particular project hires the QEP, the Qualified Environmental Professional, to assess the environmental impact of the project and determine if it is appropriate to be carried out the way the proponent wants it or is not. Now, that sounds all very innocent, all very lovely and very neutral, but in real life, it doesn't work that way at all. And why don't you talk about how you found that out directly?
An interesting foray into being a QEP under the riparian protection regulation. And so I hung my shingle out after getting my designation, and I had several calls, many actually, probably a dozen, but I got no work. And It was an interesting kind of process of talking to a prospective client about the project they wanted to undertake close to or within a riparian area.
And which for listeners is next to a water course.
That's right. And having those discussions and then not hearing back. And I think it was because they understood right away. I was from a regulatory background, and I go by the book. And even though there are some flaws with that particular piece of legislation, it's meant to protect riparian areas, and rightly so. I had a guy phone me up and say, hey, you know, I want to get rid of a tree that's, you know, danger tree. And I said, well, I'm not your person. I am a QEP, but I am not an arborist. And what you need to do is get a QEP who is an arborist and qualified to do this work for you. And I am not. And if I did the work for you, both you and I would be in trouble because that's not my specialty. And, you know, calls like that, or calls where you just have a guy and they say, you know, we want to do this. And it's clear they just wanted you to grease the skids and get the work done.
That's right. It's the old saying, he who pays the piper plays the tune. And you were right caught in the middle of it and didn't have the backing up of an employer, a ministry that would say, yes, you're doing the right thing. You had a proponent who would be very unhappy that you were stopping his or her project from going forward exactly the way they wanted to, just because it was messing up with some part of the environment, which for the proponent was not relevant, but for you as a QEP had to be relevant. Anyway, I think that is kind of characterizing the dilemma that we all face with things like the climate progression that we are all concerned about, that many proponents on a grand global scale have the idea that they want to go ahead with a project. And you or someone like you, a QEP or a chair of the Shuswap Climate Action Society, has an opinion on the subject that is very different and is based on solidly evaluated science that says this will produce detrimental effects. How do you feel about what we're doing now and where we're heading sort of in the future?
With respect to climate change, it's been extremely disappointing to see our leaders leaving climate policy behind and dismantling good climate policies because they think it's in the best interest of our economy and increasing GDP. And I just think it's a false economy, frankly, because really we rely on the planet so much for everything, clean air, clean water, our food. It's very short-sighted and it's very worrisome.
At the community level, working with the people who are part of the society, the Climate Action Society, and other people that you meet in the community, do you sense that people sort of on the ground, ordinary folks, if you want to call them that, are often a little bit further ahead in understanding what needs to be done? I know you went to your class reunion, your 50th class reunion. It was kind of disappointing you telling me about it, and hardly anybody seemed to be aware of the fact that there was a climate issue. But in the community where you know people, you know them better, you know them in more detail, do you find that there are now people who really do take these issues seriously?
Oh, for sure. I know a lot of people who are increasingly concerned about future generations. Yeah. And so it's good to see, but we need to talk to each other. We have to be talking to our friends, our neighbors, and really, I think Catherine Hayhoe has a great book about just talking about these things with each
yes.
other
yes.
and really changing the discourse at grassroots level and hopefully with our politicians as well.
Well, I can only say I'm very glad that you came into the studio today and we talked about these issues in some depth, because as you say, the more you talk, the more you know, the more you're educated, the more you're going to want to do the right thing as opposed to mistakenly or otherwise do something that is ultimately going to be destructive. So I think you've given a pretty good case for the value of activism and for having a pretty well-informed perspective on what kind of activism we should use and how we should use it and for what we should use it. So thank you very much today for coming into the studio and joining us as a guest.
Oh, thank you very much for the opportunity. Really appreciate it.